Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of the A Song of Ice and Fire blog, All Leather Must Be Boiled, at boiledleather.com. I also write about Game of Thrones and various other television shows for Rolling Stone, and I co-wrote the annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia from Westeros and Anne Grohl, the editor of the series, for the Subtext iPad app. And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a writer for Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog about all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. So check it out. It's a really good blog, and I'm really happy for today's discussion.
Yeah, me too, man. It's part of our ongoing series on the women of Westeros. I think this is... What are we up to now, Stefan? Is this part three?
I guess so, yes.
Oh, how exciting. But before we get started, I want to direct everybody to another podcast. Maybe this is bad business, sending everyone over to our competitors. But Stefan and I were recently these very special guests on an episode of a podcast of Ice and Fire, the mother of all Song of Ice and Fire podcasts. It went up, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago from the time that you'll be hearing this, me speaking right now. And it was a lot of fun. It was me, Stefan, Ashley, Kyle, and Amin. And towards the very tail end of the call, we were joined by Elio and Linda from Westeros to talk about nonsense, which was fun. And, you know, it was kind of a change of pace very deliberately from the sort of thing we usually talk about here. It was very nerdy and loose. And, you know, we talked about who would win in a fight and who do you want to have sex with and things like that. Things we don't normally touch over here. So,
no, not really.
If you ever wanted to see me and Stefan let our proverbial hair down, that's a good place to start. So we'll put a link to it in the blog post that will accompany this podcast on boiledleather.com. But chances are you're already listening to a podcast of Ice and Fire if you're listening to us, so please continue to do so. But yeah, now I guess, Stefan, if you want to start us off, tell us who we're talking about today.
Yeah, of course. So we are in our third installment now about our ongoing series of the Women of Westeros. And today we decided to tackle Catelyn and Daenerys, which may seem like a little bit odd couple at first, but really they have some stuff in common, or at least share common themes that make it interesting to compare them directly. So let's give a strong thesis in the beginning, just so we can destroy it later on in the podcast. So the thing is, Catelyn as well as Daenerys are both politicians, politician women, so to speak. And both of them use their womanhood to its own effect. They are very conscious, conscient of their womanhood, that they are women, and they are using this being a woman within the society they're in their own way to further their own political goals. In the case of Catelyn, of course, it comes with severe restrictions because she is a wife and a mother, and she works exclusively in this context, while Daenerys uses her womanhood more in a mood like Cersei would do, more for seduction and stuff. But she also is the mother for all the slaves she's freeing. So there are certain parallels between the two. And I guess it is interesting to look how you can be pointedly a woman within Westeros and a politician at the same time. And I say, while they are using the same basic principle, making no secret of what they are, a woman, they are very, very different in their approach, in their aims, and in their methods.
Yeah, that's very correct. I mean, the commonality that leaps out, obviously, is motherhood, because as you say, even though Daenerys does not have children of her own, and as far as we know, at least for the time being, is incapable of doing so, she's adopted as a mother figure, as a female savior figure, really, which I think it's interesting that that is embodied as a mother, you know, by the slaves that she frees. So And Catelyn very explicitly makes reference to motherhood and her allegiance to and attachment to and affection for her children as a motivating factor in decisions that are effectively political decisions and even military decisions, depending on how you want to look at something like freeing the Kingslayer, who's obviously seen as good enough a fighter and commander to be you know, some an asset to the enemy forces above and beyond just the fact that he's one guy, you know, just in terms of morale and his expertise and, you know, and just his the danger of facing him on the battlefield. He's seen as much more than just one random person. And, you know, she chooses to free him based on, you know, out of consideration for her status as a mother. So it's fascinating to see the different ways that the two women invoke these words and these concepts and these roles, and how it plays out differently. And I think also how successful they are, and both within the world of the story and in terms of engendering sympathy from the reader.
Yeah, exactly. I just finished another re-listening to the Game of Thrones audiobook. So it struck me a little bit at just how good a counselor Catelyn is to Rob, because she really is the best advisor he has in all of his all of the people that are surrounding him. And she also is an accepted counselor. It is really strange. The first time she encounters Rob and his host at Moat Cailin, she walks into this tent and she just belongs there. There's no one who says, hey, who is this woman and why does she want to talk with us like that? And she has no voice here. It's nothing like that. Catelyn comes in and she starts to talk to her son and everyone else leaves. And also in later councils, when they are sitting there, she is just there. It is normal. Everyone seems okay with it. This is a pretty interesting thing, because Cersei, on the other hand, suffers from this exclusion of this underlying and implied thing that she shouldn't be where she is. Kevin, for example, does this a lot. Mm-hmm. When he always tells us she should retreat to Castle Rock, and now the men are here, now it's time that she lets loose. With Catelyn, there are really many men around, but no one ever tries to get rid of her except for Rob. Right. But he does it for other reasons. So that's an interesting thing. And as I said, she really gives sound counsel. I can't stress this enough, because there is a lot of Catelyn hate out there. And Catelyn, she really does give she has the right ideas. She has a very good sense of reality, which many of the Northerners lords lack. And that's something admirable.
Yeah, and her son is among those Northern lords who lack that sense sometimes, you know, which I think is important to point out. I suppose thinking about it, her council is sort of rejected. You know, two times that strike me. You know, the first is I just remember there being a line about how, you know, effectively, if she's going to sit in on those councils, she has to be just another trusted counselor. She can't be, you know, the king can't have a mom telling him what he should be doing. You know, I think it's she who kind of understands and even introduces this idea that Rob has to be seen as his own man and can't be following her advice just because it's his mother and his mother is telling him what to do. You know, and that is what Rob bristles about, you know, more than the fact that she's a woman or, you know, a mother within that setting. It's that it's his mother and he has to kind of create his own identity. And the second thing is the Kingslayer situation, obviously, which, I mean, where do you come down on that specifically?
Yeah, the Kingslayer situation, I thought about it when you mentioned it, and it is kind of interesting because it underlies in a certain sense her grip of the realities, because at the point when she releases the Kingslayer, the fortune tables have definitely turned already against the Stark-Tully alliance, and Catelyn does really fear for the life of her girls. She can't know, of course, that Arya isn't in possession of Cersei. So she thinks about how can she get her girls back, and winning battles certainly isn't the way to go. It has become obvious at this point that the Starks will lose this war, more or less, even if their plan succeeds in recapturing Moat Cailin and stuff. All they will achieve is holding the North, and that is not a position in which you would be able to get back your children. On the other hand, If you go through with this plan, abandoning Riverlands and hiding behind Moat Cailin, it doesn't really matter whether the Kingslayer is released or not. So I guess in her perspective, this move makes sense. But I would attribute it as a very emotional one. Because Catelyn gives very sound advice, but there is one flaw that she cannot overcome, and that is when her emotions about people she knows or thinks she knows are affected. It is palpable when you see it in her assessment of Littlefinger, who she thinks that she knows, there is one instance later, I just can't get it right now out of the top of my head, where she really thinks she knows someone, and it is a misjudgment of the situation, Lysa, of course. These are the only instances. In all other things, she is fairly rational.
Well, I guess Tyrion might be a case there, where she is convinced that Tyrion is guilty, but he's not.
Yeah, but that seems to be more of a problem because of her lack of information and her misjudgment of Lysa. It's her sister that explicitly tells her that the Lannisters are involved. And then Littlefinger, who right. she thinks she knows, tells her explicitly it is Tyrion. It is right. his dagger. And right. she has virtually no reason to mistrust him, so...
Yeah, and I think Catelyn is held... And by the way, I notice this every time this character comes up. We keep flipping back and forth between Catelyn and Catelyn. And I think that more than any other name, the fact that we're supposed to pronounce Catelyn as Catelyn is the most infuriating thing to me. Why have the E there if it's Catelyn? You don't need the E. Anyway.
So is this Catelyn officially?
Well, I've heard Martin pronounce it Catelyn, so...
Okay. Then let's try hard to stick to Catelyn.
Okay. We'll do our best. But yeah, I think that Catelyn is held responsible for making mistakes that I'm not really sure they're that much worse than the mistakes that almost every other character makes, you know, with some frequency. I think because the arrest of Tyrion is seen as the first blow in the Stark-Lannister War, when in fact it's not. The first blow in the Stark-Lannister War is Jaime tossing Bran out the window. And yet, you know, it's Catelyn's move to rectify that or that situation or seek justice for that situation. Somehow that, in the minds of a lot of readers, becomes the proximate cause of the war, when in fact that was only done in response to something that the Lannisters had done. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, finish your thought.
And as you said, you know, she had her sister telling her that this was the case. She had Littlefinger, who she had no reason to distrust at this point. I mean, there was bad blood there, but Littlefinger had never been a person that had attempted to deceive her in any way, so she had no reason to doubt him in that regard. And, you know, it's weird to me how much opprobrium is directed at her for the kind of it's a mistake in judgment, a lapse in judgment, perhaps, but all the major characters do that kind of thing all the time, and it's difficult to see how it's any worse than, you know, I mean, I'd be here all day listing other things that people do that, you know, the Ned trusting Littlefinger to help him with help him secure the city, or, or Rob marrying Jane, or Cersei trusting any of the people that Cersei trusts, or, John not massaging the egos of his underlings when he's Lord Commander, or, you know, and it goes on and on and on and on. So, I don't really understand why Catelyn comes in for so much, gets so much grief over that.
I think that's just another instance of this misogyny that is in the fandom, unfortunately. The same is true for Sansa. She also received so much hate that is simply not justifiable in any means. And returning to Catelyn. Catelyn. We should score points. Returning to Catelyn, I think that she... it is often overlooked how quickly she adapts to the new information she gets when she is on the high road with Tyrion. Because once he tells her how unlogical all this stuff is that she's hurling at him, this whole story that Lysa and Littlefinger have told her, the logic holes that are in this, once he points it out, it immediately awakens doubt in her. And she thinks about it. She connects it with the information about her sister. She immediately grasps that Lysa has changed, in what way she has changed, that she's fearful and all that stuff. Of course, she can't know that she's manipulated by Littlefinger, but even be that as it may, it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
She sees that Lysa can't be trusted anymore. She also tells Rob explicitly, don't expect any help from there. So she has a good grasp of any situation, and you can see the same thing when she goes to Renly to treat with him. She understands what these people are, how they think, how they act, the Knights of Summer. That is just so fitting, and she sees it the moment she lays her eyes on them. She has a very observant eye. She sees this tourney and she thinks, oh my god, they're playing at war while being at war. Other people would have thought, oh, the splendor. But she sees beyond it. And that is something often overlooked.
Yeah, she definitely has Renly's number. That's a really... That chapter is pretty masterful. And, you know, her time in Renly's camp and dealing with him and with Stannis. And with Brienne, you know, I also think that she's just got a good handle on people in general. People, like... And you're right, people that she doesn't know well. Maybe from her youth or so, something like that, where she has formed these preconceptions about who they are and what they're capable of. I think another reason, perhaps, this is my big insight, to why Catelyn is sort of disregarded as a character or seen as a drag, and, you know, somewhat understandably so, I can see where people are coming from on this, is that in many of her chapters... as you get into Clash of Kings and Storm of Swords, she doesn't really have a whole lot of agency. You know, I mean, there's one chapter where she famously literally sees and hears battles in the great distance. There's a couple of them, actually. That's how she experiences the Battle of the Whispering Wood, and that's how she experiences Edmure turning back Gregor Clegane across the river.
Rob coming home.
Right, right. You know, so she's literally standing and watching. And why is that? Well, it's because she's a woman, and that's more or less the position to which she has been relegated. I mean, she's not on the battlefield with the commanders. She may be in the tent, you know, between battles, helping plan the course of things. But, you know, to quote There Will Be Blood, when the showdown comes, she won't be there because she's a woman. So... what's left for her to do? Just sit and watch as things happen, as other people make things happen. And, you know, that's a pattern throughout her chapters. Even when it's not something that obvious and striking and direct as her sitting at a distance and hearing a battle far away. You know, there's many cases, I think, where most of her chapter will be eaten up with relatively inconsequential goings on, and you'll spend a lot of time in her head. And then at the very end of the chapter, some other character, male, will come on screen and say, oh, this is happening. Dun, dun, dun. That's the cliffhanger, and that's the end of the chapter. You know, I think the easiest example to remember is when she's in the Sept, you know, praying on the eve of battle between Renly and Stannis, and, you know, and she has these little musings about each of the, you know, the gods of the Seven. And that's it. You know, nothing really happens until the end of the chapter. You're just spending all that time in her head, and getting sort of an info dump about the Seven, and, you know, which is interesting, but a lot of times the chapters don't really have that kind of something that meaty in terms of the world building to fuel them. So you're just spending a lot of time in someone's head who's prevented from doing all that much. And that, I think, is difficult for people, in a narrative that's as propulsive as this one, and filled with so many characters who are really are movers and shakers constantly.
I guess there is also another point that makes many readers, at least on the first or second read, dislike the character of Catelyn, and this is that she comes across sometimes as a little bit of a whiner, because she always mentions just how she has to fight back tears. She needs to be strong now. She is not allowed to weep. She will do that later sometimes. Mm-hmm. Or I want my children back and stuff like that. And if you're waiting for the next battle to resolve and for the next hero tale of Rob, then of course these are a drag, because then you have to hear the petty whining of a girl, and instead of following Daenerys and her dragons and awesome, I will burn cities to the ground, we have, oh my god, my little girls. Of course, this is a really great narrative. I mean, Catelyn ranks among my favorite characters, but I can understand why several people are not as engaged by her chapters as they could be and as they are with others.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much dead on. You know, it's a bit of a shame, because I think it's a really interesting idea to explore. You know, and in many ways, things are so different now politically than what they were at this time. You know what I mean? Like, the mother of the president is not, I mean, I'm sure she's worried about her, you know, her son's safety in terms of assassination and things like that. But, like, you know, Barack Obama or George W. Bush, they're not going out and, you know, and fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know. Neither are their kids. So it's a whole set of really compelling considerations that we don't really experience all that much in the real world, you know, with rare, weird exceptions like Prince Harry in Afghanistan and stuff like that. You know. Just to think about what that would be like. Okay, you're a lady. You know, you're the wife of the ruler of the North. You know, because of this scheme, of these things that you got involved with this family of assholes, he's got murdered. So now your son is going to wage a war to first to free him, and then when he is killed, to avenge his death and overthrow this asshole family. You know, and he's really out there leading it. You know, he's on the battlefield. He's swinging a sword. He's sending his wolf out to kill people. You know, meanwhile, your daughters have been kidnapped by this asshole family. One of them you haven't heard hide nor hair about for the longest time. One of your other sons was crippled by the asshole family, and he's back someplace, and then you find out that place has been conquered, and then you find out he's been killed along with his little brother. You know, so it's difficult to imagine the kind of pressure that puts you under as a parent. I mean, motherhood is a unique phenomenon, but I mean, just as, you know, speaking as a father, like, I really can't even imagine the stew of emotion where you want to win the war and you need to win the war, but at the same time you have the concern that all parents have, the sort of overwhelming terror at the notion that your children could be in harm's way. That's a fascinating set of issues to explore through a character, and I think that because of, as we said, the way the narrative is set up, she's at something of a disadvantage in terms of the amount of action that her chapters are capable of providing, but it's still really meaty, and I do wish, I don't even sure how to put this. I don't know if I wish Martin had found a way to come up with a storyline for her that had that would provide the action that people need, than to get at the meaty stuff underneath. I'm not really even sure how to phrase it, but, you know, there's stuff going on there that I think it'd be foolish to ignore.
Yeah, I think Catelyn's chapters are more an appeal to the maturity of the readers, because you just have to bypass your urge for stories that are of heroes, of stuff happening, you know, Catelyn riding beside her son in a glittering armor and protecting herself or something. You just won't get that in a world that is built realistically like Martin does it. So you have these restraints in place. And Martin can do these restraints only because he has so many characters that serve as POVs. So I guess it is more like a feature than it is a bug, but you have to immerse yourself in it. You have to open yourself to the possibility of a character that really doesn't do that much because he simply can't do anything. And as you said, Catelyn has little agency. Mm-hmm. She has a little bit more than Sansa does, who receives the same hate and the same arguments against her storyline, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting thing to see just how these characters cope with the world they are in. They have all these challenges, and if they want to achieve anything, to achieve their goals, keeping Rob safe, surviving in a really hostile environment, you have to use the methods that are at hand. And for Catelyn, this is using her womanhood and her motherhood. She invokes being Rob's mother at several times, and it really rescues her. For example, when she releases Jaime, she gets a very lofty tower cell because she is the mother of Rob. She also gets access to the Maester. She gets comparably good treatment and information, more than she should get for being a prisoner.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. So she's very adept in her use of the little agency that she is granted. But there is not much of it. The difference between Catelyn and many other characters, and of course the predicament of the reader, is that Catelyn accepts this. She has always accepted it. We have this great bit in A Game of Thrones where she reflects on having waited on her father time and time again when right. She's in a Whispering Wood, I guess. And that is just what she does. She is a Tully. She has fully embraced and accepted the social roles that come with Westerosi society. She doesn't rebel against it. I can't even imagine her rebelling against them as a child. She always was a woman. It was always clear that she will one day marry someone she doesn't know, that she will have to love him because it is her duty, and that she has to become a mother to create this family for him, because that's just what her purpose is. And that is a purpose she fulfills. And once she has fulfilled it, she also goes beyond what is strictly requested of her, being this birther of children for the Lord, and also counsels them. She educates them. I don't see Cersei doing any education for her children.
Yeah.
I think that is done mostly by retainers. But Catelyn really takes personal hand in the education of all her children, one after the next, and she really instills them with a very firm set of values, and with good sense. It is so striking when she thinks in Renly's camp that she would like to bang their heads together to knock some sense into them. This is an urge that comes upon her regularly, and it is not an urge that Cersei feels, for example. She never wants to beat sense into someone. She wants to beat her will into someone, and that is a very important difference to make, I think.
Yeah. Although, I mean, in terms of, you know, one of the objections that I would find valid in terms of Catelyn as a character is that if you dislike Sansa in the early going of the series, you can only blame her parents for allowing her to be educated in this way. I always thought, you know, that was one of the very first things of substance that I wrote about the series, was that it's unfair to hold against a child her espousing the values taught to her by her parents and the educators that her parents selected for her. You know, and you know, there is a certain allegiance to that system that Catelyn has, that I think we can criticize her for. But you're right. I mean, you know, one need look no further than Cersei to see a different way that system could be expressed and espoused, you know, through someone who's not even really happy being a part of it. But, you know, it's you still get a very different you know, take on motherhood and on the need to instruct one's children about moral and ethical issues from Catelyn than you do from Cersei, her sort of nearest counterpart. Different world, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think Cersei is really the only person we can compare it to, right? There are no other mothers besides Lysa, but okay, forget that. We don't really. Perhaps the Queen of Thorns. She also wants to knock sense into her son, but right. She can't because he's an oaf. So, so I guess we don't have a real comparison here because Rob is clearly more clever than Mace Tyrell.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the mother who reminds me most of Catelyn towards the end is Ilaria Sand, who, and granted, is not dealing with her own daughters. You know, she's dealing with daughters that her, you know, whatever you you know, her partner, Prince Oberyn, her companion, you know, fathered with other women. But you know, she clearly still has like a sort of motherly relationship towards them, and basically has the same, you know, like, you know, Oberyn's dead. The guy who killed him is dead. The people who killed his sister, they're all dead. You know, why do you want to keep fighting? What good does that do? And I mean, you could really take that monologue and, you know, at varying times in the narrative, put it in Catelyn's mouth. And, I think, you know, it sounds very familiar. Although, you know, obviously things change for Catelyn so much, it's somewhat, to say the least.
Yeah, she's also the one who brings up the whole peace discussion when they sit in Riverrun at the end of Game of Thrones. They talk about what are we fighting for now. I mean, Ned is dead, Jaime is captured, so what do we do now? And nobody really knows. And she's the one who proposes to make peace, which just seems such a lackluster idea to the rest of them. Oh my God, peace, typical for women, yeah, you know. But it's actually a very sound idea.
Yeah.
And she's the one questioning the whole rationale behind what they are doing, but she does so in terms they can understand, and she really tries to win them over. And she almost succeeds in them listening to her, which she regards as a major victory. And not that they do what she says, but that they listen to her. That's really something. And I guess that's... Once again, she has this realistic grasp of her abilities as a woman and the possibilities that her house has in a particular situation.
Yeah. She's fairly astute, you know, even right up until the very end and you know, being the person who's paying attention to Grey Wind, you know, she's just kind of... She sees maybe some things that other people miss because she's got nothing to do but look, perhaps. You know what I mean? Like, as you said, she spent all that time waiting. You become a decent observer, you know, at least in theory.
Would you think that Catelyn also counseled Eddard in the years that they were married? Because we don't really know, because Eddard more or less leaves right at the beginning of the story, and they never really reunite, except for this little sequence in King's Landing. But was she a trusted counselor to Eddard, as she was to Rob, or was she in a kind of minor capacity there?
It seems like it, based on the conversations they have about, you know, whether he should become Hand. You know, not that he necessarily listens or goes along with her advice every time, but I mean, I didn't put that the right way. I mean, he does listen. He considers it. He doesn't necessarily agree with it or make the decision she wants him to make every time. But, you know, he was not like, oh, I don't really want to listen to your advice about whether I should become the Hand. You know, he did listen, you know, and clearly took it under consideration, and it was a difficult decision for him, you know, because keep in mind, unlike the show, she was the one who was advocating that he take the position, because it would make them more secure in the long run, and that was clearly weighing very heavily against his hesitancy to take it. And if it, I mean, it wouldn't have been a conflict if you know, he just would have not taken it. but he valued her opinion, and because she was taking the opposite position, it became a very difficult choice for him. Oh, and that's, you know, I guess we should bring up that I think Catelyn's portrayal in the show hurts that character in the minds of readers. Obviously, the books predate the show by quite some time, if not necessarily my readership of them. I only started reading them, I guess, about a year before the show started. So you can't chalk all of it up to that. But that, to me, has always been the weak link in that ensemble in terms of the writing and in terms of the performance, frankly. I think that they hit the notes of sort of concerned mama bear so heavily and with so little subtlety that that can't help but rebound into how you think about the character when you read or reread the books. In much the same way that I think Sophie Turner's performance as Sansa has helped that character, because she's just so good, and it's impossible not to empathize with that character when you've seen this human being bring her to life, that I think that got people looking at Sansa in a new way. I think Catelyn did the same thing, but sort of in the opposite direction.
Yeah, that might be. I was never so so firmly in the camp of show Catelyn haters, because I didn't experience her just as bad, but there are notable differences. And I would agree that they change her character in this direction. I'm just not so sure whether I would join you in the condemnation of this just quite so firmly. But the change is recognizable, to say the least.
Yeah, yeah. It's a matter of taste, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess. But you're definitely right. It pushes your interpretation of Catelyn more into the weak character camp.
Right.
While Sansa really gets stronger through the show. I think I never considered it quite like that. So that is really an interesting thing. I have to weigh in a little more thinking about it. So perhaps when we do some episodes about season 3, I see us totally doing, perhaps we will come back to this topic.
That's a good idea. Well, I guess now we can switch over, and unless you had any further thoughts on Catelyn, we can switch over to the other mother that we'll be discussing today.
Yeah, of course.
Daenerys, you know, just thinking about it in show terms, that's just, you know, just to get us started. It's kind of funny because I think everyone loved her during season 1 and everyone had a lot of problems with how she was handled in season 2.
Where are my dragons?
Right, exactly. So I've heard it's almost like it almost cancels out. Like, I've definitely heard as many people say, oh, I couldn't really get into that character in the books, but now I like her. And, oh, that was one of my favorite characters, and now I don't like her anymore, which is just kind of funny to me. Daenerys, I think, is interesting because she, more than any other, literally more than any other character, more even than Jon, is directly dealing on a narrative level with the questions of morality and social justice that you and I like to talk about on the show every time. Because that is her storyline. Once you get to Slaver's Bay, and even before that, in terms of her treatment of, you know, the sack of the Lazarine village, and even before that, just in terms of her role as a child who is sold into sexual slavery, she is dealing with the rights of women, the rights of, you know, foreigners, the rights of slaves, the rights of the poor, the rights of, you know, just human rights. That is her crusade as a character within the narrative. You know, and it's all ultimately subservient to her goal to take the Iron Throne, which she never wavers from. And as a, you know, as we said in a podcast of Ice and Fire, you know, her reformist impulses never extend to questioning her own divine right to rule. But she is more than any other character, is wading right into those issues and attempting to act based on, you know, her moral compass regarding social justice. And it's always kind of And because Martin is not a Pollyanna and understands that, you know, good intentions only get you so far, we've seen what a hash Danny has made in some cases, not in all of them, but in some cases of, you know, this crusade. You know, and I suppose the best example is Astapor, which is a city where she frees the slaves and leaves, and now there's no city anymore, and now there are no people in it, because, you know, it was just, you know, they just drowned in their own blood, and then they all died from a plague. And that, in large part, was Dany's doing. Now, because she has screwed up like that, and that's just the most dramatic example, there are other ones, I think then some readers make the mistake of saying that she shouldn't care about this at all, that she shouldn't care about Slaver's Bay as a culture, what it represents, what it enables, what it does to people, and she should just get on with the business of killing her way to the Iron Throne, which I think, you know, this is very heavily litigated territory in this podcast at this point, but obviously I disagree with that standpoint. You know, and it's really just, she is the character where the rubber meets the road in terms of, you know, what do we do about human rights violations that are sort of enforced at the sword's edge? What do we, you know, where, how far do we take our pacifism in the face of great evil? You know, and it's all done in the person of a girl who's like, what is she, 14? Yeah, you know, really, really compelling character, I've always thought. What do you think?
Yeah. It is funny that you mention the attack on the Lesserine village, because just now that you threw away the comment, basically, I just thought about that this experience was a very traumatic one and a very important one for her, because she frees these people there. I forgot your name, the girl that gets raped and killed later when Drogo dies, and Miriam Azdur, and all of them. And she really thinks she did something good, inherently good, morally good. And it all turns to ash within one or two chapters, basically. So the girl gets raped when the Khalasa breaks up, and Miriam Azdur takes a very gruesome revenge on her, and tells her explicitly that what she did was not what she thought she did. She thought that she rescued these people, that she gave them their lives, but in reality she did no such thing. She just saved them from another fate, but their lives were gone, and she is at least partially responsible for it, because she married the guy who did this, and she's not exactly opposed to it. At least she wasn't when they started the whole carnage. And I think that this experience is very important for her, because from now on she doesn't do any half-assed stuff. When she does anything that goes in this direction, for example, burn down the slavers in Astapor, later Kanka Marine, it is always a full-on approach. She really is very conscient about what she wants to achieve, what she does, and why she does it. It doesn't always work out, as you just said, but it is interesting that she really has a clear sense of her aims, of her goals, and all this stuff. Of course, it falls to pieces. I mean, this is a Song of Ice and Fire and not a Harry Potter fantasy.
Right.
But without having ever read Harry Potter. I think her storyline really is compelling for me exactly because of this reason. I also experienced kind of a fatigue with Dany, because she's always in Essos. She's the only character there. These cultures are so alien. But in A Dance with Dragons, this coping with this alien culture, this attempt of trying to rule them, of really getting your hands dirty as a ruler, and not just say, oh my god, these guys are so stupid, let's all kill them and move on, like so many readers are trying to urge her, I think that really makes her into a great character and a great person.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I mean, I think great character is fairly indisputable. And, you know, I would also ask, like, you know, if we're going to give Dani a hard time for being unsuccessful in her goals, do we have an example of a successful ruler in the in the whole series?
I mean, I'm successful.
Well, someone who's, like, still alive and hasn't plunged their people into ruin.
Huh.
Like the Queen of Thorns, maybe?
Yeah, but she's not not technically a ruler.
Right.
Lysa Arryn. I mean, don't know. Yeah, I think Doran Martell qualifies.
Yeah, I suppose so. Although I don't think things are going to end well for old Doran, and he's had to swallow a lot of shit to get to, you know, the position where he is. And
yeah, everyone again, does.
Right, and this, but I think I don't. You know, the same people who are criticizing Dany for taking their time can't possibly look to Doran Martell as a positive example of leadership. You know. So, you know, I'm not sure that that it's all that fair to Dani. I mean, I think Dani comes in for more criticism because she's more ambitious. She is the most ambitious ruler that we've seen.
By a long shot.
Oh, yeah, by far, yeah.
There's really no one that has ambitions that go over a power grab.
Right, exactly.
The other rulers, they always want to extend their power to new areas. They want to rule about more land, perhaps get the Iron Throne or something. But Dani, she doesn't just want the power. She wants that too, obviously. But she also wants to fundamentally alter the people she governs. I mean, she sees, oh, slavery is evil, so let's destroy slavery, bang. And she doesn't even think about passing a 13th Amendment or something. So it is just her will with which she tries to really force things into being. She's a very strong-willed person, and she has learned to her own sorrow that this is not enough. You have to get into contact with other people. You have to compromise. You have to work, and you have to find this very delicate balance. This is the point I made in my essays about the war and the peace in the North and the East, these four essays that you can check out at the Tower of the Hand, that she and John both encounter the same problem because they have their visions, their radical visions, and their underlings don't share them, but they need to work with their underlings, and both of them go into one extreme and both of them fail. And it is very hard not to fail. I mean, just look in our real world, how many democracies failed over the last decades just because they couldn't get the balance right. It is a very hard thing to create a successful rulership. Mm-hmm. And most rulers, they play it safe. Of course, they just follow the old traditions, the old oaths and stuff. And if you want to change something, you're going into uncharted territory. It is a very dangerous thing, a dance on rotten ice. And most will make a royal splash. Quoting Littlefinger here, I guess.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. And you know, I just think it's a big mistake to look at Slaver's Bay and not think that someone in Dani's position wouldn't try to do something. I mean, it's really remarkable to think that she sits and stays to rule Meereen and try and heal Meereen. I mean, I can't think of anyone who would do that, you know, if they were just plopped into Dani's storyline from their own storyline and been like, okay, here's your situation. What are you going to do? It's difficult to imagine anybody else saying, well, this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, yes, you know, there's an element of sort of the white savior. There's an element of sort of cultural hubris in trying to be the person who's going to bring, you know, enlightenment to this place. Although I don't really think she ever looks, you know, she never really talks about it in those kinds of George W. Bushian terms. You know, I think it's fairly clear that America's experience in Iraq and Afghanistan informed the storyline in Dance, but I don't think it's a 100% crystal clear analog, because Dani, I mean, we see Dani, we see through her eyes, we have POV chapters, we know how she thinks, and we know she is legitimately moved by suffering. It's not something that she feels, it's not an ego trip for her. I don't think that's fair. And the other thing that we've barely touched on, although I guess I brought it up already once, is that she's a teenager. And, you know, Dani as a character is interesting for Martin's depiction of a teenager who's sort of forced to grow wise beyond her years. And, you know, teenage dumb is not a concept that any of these people have access to. You're a child and then you're an adult. And even childhood is a different beast than it is today. You know, from child labor on down. So, you know, it's a mistake to look at it as some kind of commentary on adolescence as a state of being, but, you know, but he's clearly trying to consider, you know, that the emotions and desires and drives and fears of people who are that age, you know, are surely, to an extent, universal, you know, because your brain development would basically work the same in a society that existed before the concept of teenager as it does today, because it's human brains. So she's bringing a lot of that to the table. And the most obvious example is her, the way she's sort of smitten with Dario and, you know, in Alyssa Rosenberg's memorable phrase, teenage fuck fever, you know, which is awesome that that's being written about in this context. You know, it's really fascinating. And again,
for a time,
what'd you say?
I never quite understood why so many people give Danny a hard time about fucking Dario.
Right.
I mean, there are very few actions that are so inconsequential than sleeping with that guy. But she really got some heated criticism for it, and I never really understood why.
Yeah, I can't really see what deleterious effect that's had on her goals in the real world. I mean, people don't like Dario because they think he looks stupid and he's annoying.
He does.
You know, and he does. He looks stupid and he's annoying. That's true, you know. But again, you know, we're trying to consider the world that she comes from. I think someone pointed out that she spent a lot of time as a kid in Tirosh. And since he's Tiroshi, you know, I'm sure he looks appealing to her in a way that she's understood men could look appealing. You know, and is he trustworthy? No. Is he moral? No. But, you know, to Danny, he's hot. And, like, that happens sometimes with teenagers, man. You know, and unless and until, you know, while they're in the middle of the act, you know, he's like, oh, by the way, like, you know, I'm not going to go down on you again until you burn this pyramid to the ground. And she's like, well, okay. You know, I don't really even know why it's relevant to criticize her over it. Because that's not, I mean, that hasn't happened. It won't happen. So, obviously, unfortunately, for Dario, it's not going to happen now. So, yeah, it's what a weird line of criticism.
Yeah, I guess we should touch on the topic of her being the mother of her slaves, because this becomes, in some cases, until the last chapter of A Dance with Dragons, it becomes the final cornerstone of her personality. She develops in certain stages. She becomes Khaleesi. Then she gets these prophecies, and she goes to Astapor and stuff. But it is only when these people whose chains she breaks begin to call her mother, and then she really becomes someone else. This is the one thing that enables her to even consider conquering the Iron Throne at some point. I really can't imagine Dany in her state of, let's say, Game of Thrones, heading at the top of the Dothraki horde, conquering the Seven Kingdoms, and then be a good ruler. You know,
right.
She really needs these experiences. It is funny how it mirrors the development of Aegon, because the whole rationale behind this Aegon blot is that he is trained his whole life to be a good king. And Dany, paradoxically, she was never trained for anything besides being a sex slave for her brother. And she learns it hard way, which might be even a superior training to Aegon's. She certainly lacks certain skills like languages, the Sivas, the mathematics and history and stuff. Mm-hmm. But she has a very firm understanding of just what ruling really is, what you can achieve, what you can't achieve, what really is something that is beneficial to your people, and what is something that sounds good on paper but in reality doesn't play out.
Right.
And I guess the two would make a great couple. I just don't see it happening, but I guess they would really complete each other in a way.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I think if you look at the group that she's assembled around herself and her ability to command them, when you think about those meetings in A Dance with Dragons and this motley crew of like an ex-Kingsguard and some sellsword captains and some Myrinese noblemen who threw aside their previous ways of life to be on this person's side, and a sailor and slaves and Unsullied and all these guys, a pit fighter, this is her council, and they're like legitimately looking to her for leadership and like deferring to her. And any one of them, and Dothraki and stuff, and like they, physically, I don't think any of them, I mean, they need to be worried about each other. If one of them made a move, the other ones would defend her. But I mean, it's not like, if you're Roose Bolton and you're whispering in Robb Stark's ear, and somehow you get in your head, I should just take this dude out. You have to be afraid because Robb Stark could fight you and hurt you. Dany's a 14-year-old girl. She's got dragons, but I mean, she commands their respect because she projects, an inner character that demands it. She doesn't. Well, let me put it this way: she doesn't demand it. She commands it. And all these seasoned, salty dogs that she surrounded herself with, they sense that and they react to it. And I think that's a real testimonial to Dany and Dany's innate strength. There's all sorts of other considerations, all their legitimacy in society flows from her. And if she were gone, things would look very differently instantaneously. And as we see, that's the case for people who fall out of favor when Dany disappears. But I really do think you need look no further than that council that she's assembled and holds together, through sheer force of will at that tender age, blessed or cursed with a gender that's usually treated with disrespect.
Yeah, that's a good question you're just bringing up. Is it a blessing or a curse for her? So let's say on the average, is it helpful or is it harmful that she is a woman and doesn't know such thing?
Well, it gives her that awesome catchphrase, so that's an advantage that she wouldn't have if she were a dude. All things considered, I wouldn't want to have been her at the beginning of Game of Thrones. I mean, she...
No.
Yeah, right. I mean, she's given to, one of the world's most dangerous men as a party favor. And, she has no role, no agency in that. It's a terrifying life. She's an abuse victim. It's obviously a very complex issue to unpack her relationship with Drogo and how that proceeds. And I'm actually kind of amazed that it hasn't been more of a problem for the show or the books, particularly the show. Like, I know when my wife tried to watch the pilot and was so upset she needed to take anti-anxiety medication because it was so traumatizing for her to see that scene when she's crying and Drogo's stripping her. And I understand why the show did what they did. They felt like they couldn't have them start with this tender night and then figure out a way to convey that, despite that initial tenderness, she's still miserable, and then she finds it within herself and blah, blah, blah. They needed to have like a steady arc. And that's an unfortunate side effect of television, which maybe those guys didn't have the best grip on right away because they were new to it. But it's a really difficult scene, and it's a difficult scene no matter how you slice it, because by contemporary standards, she's not capable of consent, because he's an adult and she's not. And she has no choice. Martin has to work really hard in that opening sex scene of demonstrating why this child would find it okay to have sex with a stranger who doesn't speak her language and who's a terrifying guy. And it's hard, I think it's difficult for us. Hopefully it's difficult for us to you know, recognize that situation, you know, and contextualize it in a way that makes moral sense to us today. But, you know, once you get past that point, I don't know, you know, by the time you get to dance, I'm not sure that you can point to a whole lot that goes on where you can say, oh, this would be different for Danny if she were a man. You know, I assume a male conqueror would have been expected to marry into a noble Myrinese family, just like she is. You know, a male. I don't think she has demonstrably more difficulty commanding her advisors, as I just said, than a male would. So, you know, and then obviously there's an extent to which she uses her feminine wiles, for want of a better term, to advance her agenda, you know, because by this point she's famously literally the most beautiful woman in the world. So it's one of those cases where she's fought for a position of rough equality with men and achieved it, I would say, by the time of dance.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, and I think it has much to do with the aforementioned alien culture of Essos, because she styles herself as kind of a warrior princess, so to speak, the most beautiful woman in the world, and she has these strange and colorful counselors and all of that, and she conquers, and she has dragons. So this is interesting, this is exciting, and I can totally see people flocking to her cause, especially in such a colorful society as is Labor Spain. And I guess, this is just a guess, of course, but I would say that she will get some problems when she comes to Westeros. If she doesn't appear as a savior from the onset because she just arrives in time with her dragons to melt away the others, and I surely hope that this won't be the case, then she will get several problems just being a woman. That she personally thinks she has overcome by now, because she totally does in the East.
Right.
It is irrelevant in Meereen that she's a woman, because she is the mother of dragons. She could also be the father of dragons. It doesn't matter. It is the of dragons that matters.
Yeah.
And what she did. But when she comes to Westeros, she will invoke comparisons with Aegon the Conqueror, of course, and much more recent with Aegon, be it a false Aegon or a real Aegon, we don't know it yet, but it is a male, and a good-looking male, and a guy that enjoys the favor of Dorne and of John Connington, and perhaps up to this point other guys as well. And I think that will be a tough situation for her to get into. She comes with such a colorful troop, of Unsullied and Freedmen, and then there's perhaps Jorah Mormont and Tyrion and other outcasts and stuff, and she's a woman on top of all of that, and there's these weapons of mass destruction. I think that that makes a very strange mix that can get very explosive powered on the Westerosi society.
Yeah. And that's actually a really great point to bring up, because when Dany arrives in Westeros, just as you said, I mean, that's what the real test will be for her as a woman. And, you know, one of the questions that always comes up when we talk about the end game for the series is, how different will Westeros be, presuming that humanity wins the fight against the others, which, you know, I think we all presume. You know, the question, getting there is half the fun. But once you've gotten there, what do things look like? How much of the system remains intact, you know, in terms of the power of the king and the role of the sexes, and you know, whether, you know, depending on how Daenerys does in getting there, and what state she's in when she gets there, and what state she finds Westeros in, how the battle goes, and whether she survives, just her very existence alone.
It upsets social balance.
Exactly. And it'll be a big determining factor for how that society looks when things are all over. Just the Daenerys herself is a game changer.
Yeah, it will be for her a very interesting thing because she has gone through all these trials. She has done so many things in the East, and nobody in Westeros will even have heard of it. And then she comes there and she thinks she has done all this stuff, freed Astapor, conquered Meereen, she tamed Drogon. Now she's ready to fight the others, and she's a girl.
Right.
that must be so ridiculous and an obstacle that she will think is easy to overcome because, after all, she's Mother of Dragons, blah, blah, blah. And I think it will prove really hard and drive her nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's my last point about Daenerys.
Mine too, man. Well, this was a lot of fun. These are characters, for whatever reason, I don't think I've talked a whole lot about. So
yeah, me too.
Yeah, it was fun hashing this stuff out with you. And
likewise.
Yeah, and man, this is our third week in a row with a podcast or something like that. Very close to it, right? If you count Podcast of Ice and Fire. Well, good for us. And thank you, everyone, as always, for listening. The feedback that we've gotten recently, I think just being on a podcast of Ice and Fire prompted people who listen to both podcasts to like speak up who maybe hadn't before because it was kind of an unusual circumstance. And we've gotten a lot of really wonderful and validating feedback from listeners, and we really do appreciate it. It's a lot of fun to think about you all out there listening and getting something out of this stuff. So thank you very much, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.